Sutton continues his championship charge with a dominant Ford side win all three races at Thruxton. Is it good for the sport? Is it good for the championship? We're here to discuss Thruxton Review.
Hello and welcome back to the British Touring Car Podcast. We are back once again to take our look over at the Thruxton weekend, and this weekend a little bit different. We're going to voice a few opinions over a few issues that have been raised after the weekend. We will of course take you through all the sessions of the weekend first of all, be that qualifying, race one, race two and race three. But there will be plenty to discuss towards the end, so we will get straight into qualifying. So qualifying then on Saturday afternoon was nice and sunny, nice and bright, and there was what we thought one man to beat from practice, and that was Josh Cook, having topped both practice sessions. Russ, you were eating a little bit of humble pie up until then, weren't you?
Just refer to this throughout the pod. By the way, hello. Yes, I'm well, thank you. Glad to hear you are too. Good to skip those bits. Good stuff.
We don't need formalities this week.
No. I, full disclosure, didn't see any of qualifying because I was down in sunny Brighton for the day. So you were in charge of the qualifying report, as always, and all the social media afterwards. So if it was great, then it was my delegation. If it was terrible, then Sam was indeed on social media duty.
Thanks very much.
It doesn't happen very often, so, you know. But yeah, so qualifying, you're going to have to sort of hold my hand through this one, I think, mate, because I haven't even seen the lap.
No. So obviously both FP1 and FP2 sessions were topped by Cook, and you were slightly quaking in your boots. However, Ash Sutton came to the fore once again and didn't have any lap times deleted in what was a session full of them this time round. He ended up fastest in the session. Him, Ingram and Cook were all challenging at the top for the majority of the session. But it was Sutton that came out on top, just over 2/10 faster than Ingram. Cook held it for a little while, I think up until the midpoint of the session, and you were rather worried then that he was actually going to go on and do what you'd hoped he hadn't. But yeah, it was fairly competitive at the top end. There were a couple of talking points, shall we say, throughout the session. The session finished with all three Astras inside the top eight, which was an amazing effort from them. Something we probably expected, but not quite to this extent. Did you expect the Astras to be finishing fourth, seventh and eighth?
No, I did not. The PMR boys, we expect them to go fairly well around here based on previous recent history.
Yeah.
But yeah, I wasn't expecting all three to be in the top 10. And I wasn't expecting Mikey Doble to be the highest placed of the Astros come the end of the session either. But for some reason, the car does work around here. And they had a great sort of one lap pace to get themselves into the top 10. Really good effort. And at that point, my bet for Watson to be the Jack Searsman of the weekend was looking very promising.
Yes, it was looking very promising. Things went on to change that, however, which we'll get on to. Towards the end of the session, Aaron Taylor-Smith's Astra did start to leak a little bit of oil onto the track, which made it a little bit interesting for drivers going off through Noble. This was practically as the checkered flag was flown for the end of the session, though. So although drivers ran wide, people didn't lose any laps that were on quick ones, and it didn't affect any of them trying to go any quicker. The main controversy of qualifying, though, and I'm going to have a little bit of a rant about this.
You want to take over my soapbox for a little while, so please, look after it well. I need it for later.
So, as the session was progressing, I think it was getting into the final 10 minutes or so, Camish came through the last chicane, and as we know at Thruxton, you've got two big tyre bundles on the inside of each part of the final chicane, which are trying to put drivers off from cutting too much across the inside kerb and gaining lap time. They do a very good job of it. We saw a couple of the minis on the Sunday actually charge into one of them, and they do a very good job at stopping cars as well. But Camish had come through here and nudged the first tyre bail to the left-hand side, making the corner easier to get through, and you're able to take more kerb, therefore more momentum, and quite possibly gain lap time. Now, he did this with probably 7 minutes of the session left. The session continued until about 2.5 minutes to go, when a red flag was flown. No drivers had gone off the circuit, no cars had broken down, and we were, even the commentary team and me as a viewer that day, were confused as to why. And the only reason was that those tyre bales had moved. But in that 5 minutes of time between the bale having moved and the red flag being flown, there were several drivers that consequently improved their lap time. Now, I'm not saying they improved their lap time solely in that final set of corners or in the final sector, but it certainly looks like it could have been, it could have happened quite easily. My issue is that the session was then stopped to put that back into the right place, stopping drivers then further improving through that section and taking lines that drivers had been taking in that previous 5 minutes. Effectively, you're stopping the session to change the track conditions. And that doesn't sit quite nicely with me. If you're going to stop the session for something like that, it needs to be stopped straight away, so there aren't any drivers that are going to take full advantage of it. And it really confused me, in all honesty. Your thoughts?
Obviously, I haven't seen the incident, to sound like Arsene Wenger. But what I will say is, the whole track limits mess, and it's a mess, just gets messier and messier, doesn't it? Yep. Because you're right, if you're going to put something on the line to stop track limit abuse, and that's effectively what it's there for, it's, yes, to stop cutting the corner. So if that's gone, and you're right, in that intervening period where they decided whether to put it back or not, they have to be marshalling track limits there. So they should be giving warning flags during that period. Or, as you say, okay, that's been moved, we're going to neutralise the race straight away, or qualifying session straight away, and put it back. I agree with you. It doesn't seem right that for 5 minutes, if you happen to be on track at that time, you can improve it. You could potentially improve at that time, yep, by potentially abusing track limits and not getting picked up on it, because I'm guessing that that section wasn't under review for track limits because the tyre barriers stop you from, by the very definition, from committing a track limit offence, because otherwise your bumper will be into the field behind you. So, yeah, I think that, without getting too hyperbole, and I do like a bit of that kind of stuff, and you know, I do think that this season they've got themselves in an almighty mess with track limits. And I think that in the summer break, they really need to have a think, not just BTCC, but Motorsport UK, along with all other bodies, whether it be TOCO, whether that be whoever it might be, need to have a real think about how is this going to actually be monitored and enforced in the future. Because at the minute, it's all over the place. To me, you can't have people losing wins, you can't have people losing lap times, you can't have people being penalised with 5 second, 10 second penalties if you're then going to allow a 5 minute period where anything goes, effectively.
Yes, very much agree. And I think the fact was that this weekend at Thruxton, there was only one part of the circuit that was being monitored for track limits.
Well, this is the daft thing, and that's been mentioned a couple of times, isn't it? That not every corner in the country is going to be monitored. Nope. And actually, I can't remember who said this on Twitter, and I do apologise. I was looking for it today. One way around this track limit debacle would be to release the camera pictures to the public, because they're there. And actually, somebody had released some of Brands Hatch. I don't think it was touring cars. I think it was something else. And you can see where the track limit occurs. You go, okay, fair enough. That's clearly a track limit violation. And actually, that then kills any conspiracy theory that they're letting Ash win by making sure everybody else gets a track limit warning but him.
Well, there was a photographer at Snetterton who stood photographing the exit curb of turn 10, which is the fast left-hander on the infield. And in a 15-second moment, I think there were 10 cars that went through that, and maybe 6 of them were over track limits. But because it wasn't being monitored at that corner, it wasn't being picked up. And therefore, you can have drivers running a little bit wide, taking that extra momentum through the corner, gaining that, whether it be a thousandth or a hundredth of a second, in touring car terms, that can make a massive difference. Less so probably this season from the times that we've seen throughout qualifying and stuff like that. But if you need that extra little bit of momentum in the race, maybe, to sling one down the inside into the next right-hander, it makes all the difference.
Yeah, as I say, track limits are an absolute mess this season, and we will be picking that up on our 10-minute with podcast that we'll be bringing out during the summer. Other than that, qualifying, I understand, was a fairly, like Thruxton, drab affair.
It was. Again, we saw 13 drivers covered by 1 second. Ash Sutton, as I said, taking the fastest time with 1:15.489. From Tom Ingram, Josh Cook, as we've mentioned, Mikey Doble up in fourth, leading the Jack Sears. Jake Hill taking fifth from Colin Turkington. Then the other two Astros in seventh and eighth of Watson and Taylor Smith. Dan Kamish down in ninth, slightly disappointing for our predictions, really.
Massively so.
Roy Butcher, now on the BTCC website, driving a Toyota GR Sport.
Excellent, excellent.
Along with Ricky Collard in 11th, Dan Lloyd 12th, Bobby Thompson 13th, Dan Rowbottom in 14th, and Adam Morgan in 15th. Disappointing performance again from Sam Osborne down in 20th.
Not for me, it wasn't.
And Nick Halstead was the slowest on track.
Great news for me, that was, with the... Yes. Jack Sears predictions. Should we move on to race one? I've got my flag ready.
Go on then.
Right, so race number one, and an early heartbreak for PMR and for me, as Watson had to be withdrawn effectively from the starting grid. Because he had a broken suspension hub on the way to the starting grid, which is just pain.
You could see the pain in the team principal's face when Louise interviewed him on track, going, yeah, we've got to get everyone out of the way, get this car into the pit lane and get it changed as quickly as possible, which they did a fantastic job with.
Absolutely. I have a bit of note for this race. It's 100 and up, or... at the time was 100 and up for Rowbottom, so a nice little milestone for him.
Yep.
Where do we go? That is basically the race in a nutshell. Sutton got off the grid well, and that was that. He decided that he was going to go and start up in Cheshire ready for the next round. Yeah.
To be fair, he didn't gain as much of a lead as he did at Snetterton in the opening laps, but I think that's because everyone was on the same tyre.
Yeah, that was a... we'll get onto that after we've gone through the race. That's basic. I mean, I'm not... that is basically it, really, for action. I mean, Cook and Hill had a battle for about three corners before Cook got back in front, and that was that. Boutel was forced into the pits with grass in the radiator. Not sure how it happened. Jelly was spun by Chilton at the chicane, final chicane. This caught out... Osborne, who was unfortunately collected in that, no fault of his own. And I have to say, the Halstead one didn't look great on replay. Halstead then hit Osborne's stricken car, wasn't it? He hit.
Sorry, so Osborne was trying to recover back into the race. Halstead didn't seem to slow down at all. There were plenty of drivers that took avoidance and going the opposite side of those tyre bundles, but he kept on steamrolling through by the look of it.
He arrived at some speed and hit Osborne's car with some velocity. I can't believe the yellow flags wouldn't have been being waved, given that he arrived on the scene in touring car terms an eternity after the accident.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't want to keep picking on Halstead every podcast because it gets boring and I don't want to keep repeating myself. But yeah, it just feels that every race there's something that he's involved in that he perhaps shouldn't be. It
needs to be more awareness from my side.
After this, we have problems for Rowbottom, who had a puncture, and Lloyd, we don't know what the problem was. He just dropped through the field and had to come to the pit lane. Ricky Collard with a nice move on Morgan. I put that down, but I can't remember it.
It's around the outside through the complex, wasn't it?
Oh, yes, it was. Yes. Yeah, you're right. Good scrap for eighth. Yeah, Sutton with a very easy win. I think we just have to accept at some point, regardless of your views on the Ford, which we'll come to, we are watching greatness with Ash Sutton. He is going to go down as a touring car legend. It's as simple as that.
Yeah.
And my last note for this race is a good effort by Watson to come from the back of the field to come to 17th in the final standing.
Yeah, he managed to get out on that lead lap when the cars all started. I think the car was dropped down off the jacks as the lights went out. So good timing from PMR and well worked by them. And it gave him a chance to get back into the race and get back into what was scheduled to be a really good weekend for him.
Yeah, so he did well to get back to near the point. So that set him up nicely for race number two. So to give you the result from the race, have I missed anything? I don't think so. Unfortunately, it just wasn't a classic, was it?
Not too much. Mikey Double, as we probably expect, dropped back behind a few drivers, obviously having started in fourth.
Yeah.
With the likes of Hill, Camish, Turkington, a Butcher behind you, you're kind of expecting those two or those four to probably get past him, which they did. But still, a solid top eight result for him.
Absolutely. So Ash Sutton took the win from Tom Ingram and Josh Cook on the podium, his first of the year, and he took fastest lap as well. Jake Hill fourth from Dan Camish. He made good, quiet progress through the field. I don't actually remember seeing him make a single overtake in this race, but
I don't think it was picked up on camera, mate.
So he's there anyway. Ahead of Colin Turkington, Rory Butcher, Mikey Doble, as you mentioned, down in eighth position. And Taylor Smith took home ninth from Bobby Thompson. Ricky Collard in 11th, Tom Chilton in 12th, Adam Morgan 13th, Aidan Moffat in the points in 14th, and Ronan Pearson rounding out the points in 15th.
Yeah, an interesting race. Fairly processional. At points, but fairly processional. It was interesting to see how the top four drivers just managed to almost escape away from the pack. All setting times within the 1:16s. No one else got really that close. And those three out front pretty much dominated the first two races, as we'll get on to now in race two. Copy and paste, sorry. Race two. Sutton, excellent start. Once again, gets the car off the line. He's learned exactly what to do in that car. And again, he probably hasn't changed the setup much from Brands. Powell and Hamilton managed to come together in this race on lap two with significant front-end damage resulting for Powell as he got turned across the track in that transition from turn one to turn two. Ripped the whole front bumper off, front cross member. And then he kept on wandering down the road with the bonnet up over the windscreen.
It's worth just mentioning on that he hit that barrier, metal barrier, over 100 mile an hour. These cars, and people may have seen the crash in Suzuka this weekend as well. It's just worth pointing out again just how well these racing cars are built and what an achievement to engineering they really are. Because if I hit a barrier 100 mile an hour on the motorway, I don't think I'd be driving my car back to the nearest garage and then going, whoops, that was a bit hairy.
And you also probably won't have them fixing it within 2.5 hours, ready for race three. Looking like a brand new car as well. So credit to One Motorsport for that.
Absolutely.
In lap three, we saw Gamble pull off with a broken rear toe link. Not sure what caused that. Again, no replays.
It's not going particularly well for Gamble, is it? In these opening four rounds at Toyota?
Not especially. This is probably his poorest showing. He didn't seem to have much pace this weekend. Along with that DNF really doesn't help. I think we need to start seeing a bit more from him. I know Ricky Collard and Butcher have been in the car a year already, but they're certainly getting to grips with it and finding the performance out of the car.
I think Collard was doing better at this point last year than Gamble is now.
Okay. Fair enough. We saw Bobby Thompson slowing towards the end of lap four.
Did you see what happened? Did you hear what happened?
Yeah, he unfortunately got a stone through the radiator, dropped all the coolant out of the car and fried another engine, which will probably mean that he's up for another 5-point deduction for another engine being used, which...
Possibly not, because they didn't put him out in race three, so it's possible that they've just decided to salvage that engine.
It is possible. It depends how far it's gone and how hot it got, to whether it will be usable again. Lap five, incidents continued as Robot was pushing his way through the field at this point, trying to make up for a poor race one, should we say. Obviously had that tyre delamination, had to come in, change the tyre, and was working his way back from about 24th, but had a coming together with Pearson through the complex.
Yeah, sloppy.
Very sloppy. It's a move that he went on to pull much more cleanly throughout the rest of the day and make good progress. And he was one of the main drivers doing the overtaking this weekend. But yeah, this was definitely a push to pass on Pearson. Pearson dropped down a couple of positions as a result of it. And I think Robotton got a reprimand for it.
He got a three-place grid penalty for the next race.
Yes. And then there was also an eight-car battle pack for 15th. For the final point, there were loads of drivers in there battling towards it, including your man, Dexter Patterson, who would eventually come out in 15th in this race.
I like Dexter Patterson. Yeah. I can't tell you really why. They just think about it. For a lad so young, who's basically making his tin top debut in racing, let alone just in touring cars, but in racing at the highest level, there's something about him. There just is something about him.
Shades of Moffat at that age, possibly, or better?
I don't remember Moffat doing this sort of thing at that age with a car like that and a team which has got problems, if I'm being honest with you. I don't want to get too excited too early, but he's puts me more in mind of, and I'm going to get crucified for this, Tom Ingram when he was going through. There's a clear racer who understands racing.
Yeah.
And he's in a car that's not necessarily the same last year in the Infinity. Actually, he got some fantastic results in that car, given what a piece of trash it turned out to be throughout the season.
Yeah, it was.
And actually, he looks, I'd argue at times, more at home than Moffat did in that car, which can happen. But yeah, I'm very excited about Patterson just because I want to see how far he can go. He's very young, obviously, and he just looks very at home in a very difficult series. You think of some of the drivers that are here who don't look at home, who are way more experienced and who have also in the past, think of the drivers that have been in the sport that haven't really been able to settle despite the experience. And you look at this kid who looks just so at home amongst everyone else.
Let's just hope that he does get the support that he needs and he's also able to carry on in the sport financially, because that could be a big issue for him going forwards. His teammate Jade Edwards, again, pulled off on lap 12. More car troubles. And she would also, I think, see the same fate in race 3 as well.
I'll note to that. That's a whole note you've just taken off of it.
Sorry. But yeah, it's not looking good for that side of the garage this year.
I'll cover it in my race because I need something to talk about.
Yeah, and Sutton, really, without being challenged at all, went and took another win. His sixth win of the season in 11 races at this point, and he took fastest lap.
And the first person in British touring car history to take a hat-trick of double wins. Why he was quite emotional at the end of race 2.
Nice stat there, sir.
I hope it's right. That's how I understand it. But yeah, so he has won a double race for the third time on the bounce, which hasn't been done before, to my best of my knowledge, which fair I think enough. Is why he was so emotional at the end of race number 2.
Yeah. So obviously Ash Sutton took the win from Ingram, who was a little way behind, 2.2 seconds by the end of the race. Cook finished in third once again, followed by Hill, Camish, Turkington, Butcher, the same top seven, basically, as race one. Aaron Taylor-Smith in eighth, followed by Ricky Collard in ninth. Moffitt managed to get his Civic up to 10th. Dan Rowbottom 11th, Morgan in 12th. Chilton in 13th. Mikey Doble unfortunately dropped all the way back to 14th. However,
he's still points.
And he still took the Jack Sears win for that round.
Yeah.
And then obviously Dexter Patterson in 15th in his Cupra.
Right, race number 3. And the first thing that Ash Sutton did wrong all weekend, really, was to pull out number 12. I think that I said anything from 8 or lower and he probably wins. And actually, maybe on race 3's pace, that was a bit optimistic. But
I was going to say, before the race, I was like, yeah, I'm probably with you on that. But then when, as we saw race 3 progress, I was like, hang on, where's the pace gone?
It's worth pointing out that Ricky Collard managed to pick up an official reprimand in this race for, and I quote, excessive weaving on the way to the grid.
Excessive weaving.
I don't want to feed too much into the Collard conspiracy, but I do kind of sometimes think, come on. Like,
what's excessive? Surely you've got to be weaving excessively to warm your tyres up.
Yeah, I mean, I haven't gone back and watched it, to be fair, so I can't like say, oh, okay. But I just think to myself, you see some of the sudden sharp braking, I often think, Christ, they're going to run into each other here on the way to the grid. I really, as I say, I don't want to feed into the Collard conspiracy and nobody likes cards at Toka or whatever, but that to me, I say I haven't seen it, but on paper, that just seems a bit, I don't know.
It's an unusual one. It's not something that we've ever seen before either.
Not that I can remember, no. As you mentioned, race two in your notes, you managed to steal two off me, so thank you very much. Roe Bottom was given a three-place grid penalty, and Bobby Thompson was withdrawn from race number three. You've also managed to steal this point as well. That was a good rebuild on Powell's car to get him out for the race, so we're covering old ground there. The first real piece of news from this race was the good start by Morgan, as you expect, BMW off the line, yada, 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 goes very well into the distance. Roe Bottom would then start his way through the field. A very good move on Collard for third, which they had a nice little battle for a lap and a half or so with good ballsy moves by both drivers. That was really good to see.
Yep.
We then saw a fantastic move by Roe Bottom on Moffat for second, which was a nice cutback through the complex. Good. Again, putting to bed the rumours that Roe Bottom can't race. He is a good racer. Roe Bottom then just took chunks out of Morgan. I think it was closing at something like 0.4 a lap or something stupid. So that was good fun.
First of all, I couldn't believe how much of a gap Morgan had managed to build at the front, to be fair.
Yeah.
And he had done that over Moffitt. Moffitt was a bit of a cork in a bottle until Roe Bottom had got past. But the closing speed that Focus had on the BMW towards the end of the race was ridiculous.
It was, and he took the lead at Church at the fastest corner of the track for a really nice sort of overspeed.
Drove past him.
And that is race three, other than to say that Edwards had another retirement, shows some frustration by punching the roof of her car. And I get it, and I do worry. I don't know where she finds the mental strength, to be honest, because if that was me, every week, and it is every week, there's a problem with the car. But how do you carry on? You've worked so hard to get on the grid. You really have put everything on the line to get your sponsors here to get yourself on the grid. And it just feels that this is a complete waste of a season for her, unfortunately. It's got shades of Parfit last year, that nothing seems to really work. Everything seems a bit botched. Everything seems a bit rushed. We know that there's potentially problems with the car, but it just seems that what I can't wrap my head around is that you've got Patterson, who is in and around the points most races. And if he's not in 14th, 15th, he's 16th, 17th, 18th, he's there or thereabouts.
Yeah.
And Edwards is just miles off, and not through her own fault, through the fault of the fact the car just can't seem to finish a race.
Do you know something that I also question that I hadn't actually thought of before we obviously started recording tonight, is all these problems that we're finding with this car on this side of the garage. Obviously, we know drivers come into a season with a damage budget as such, and repairs that have to be made along the way, whether it be cosmetic or mechanical. Is she having to foot the bill for these issues?
Don't know.
I really would like to know how they work out what is reliability-based, what is self-inflicted, whether they only have to pay for their self-inflicted damage, or what. It would be really interesting to find that out.
Because she's not been in a crash this season, because the car's not lasted long enough for it to be in a crash. No. She's not been able to be competitive. And I really do feel for her, because we're not seeing the best of her. And I don't necessarily think it's for any fault of her own. The car just doesn't seem to be up to task. And whether this is just unfortunately part and parcel of the fact that they're running six cars and it's difficult, and they've had to take a bit of a decision on who they're going to prioritise. And you can understand why Thompson and Lloyd are prioritised.
Yeah.
I think Patterson is probably the third priority, given that he is there and thereabouts more often than not. And I think, unfortunately, the other three are down sort of the priority list, to be honest with you.
Fortunately.
Well, that pretty much sums up the race weekend. Just to give you the classification for race number three, Dan Rowbottom from Adam Morgan, from Aidan Moffitt in third, his first purge of the season. And it did well to keep behind Turkington, who I am surprised didn't put more pressure on, but then I'm not surprised because I say it every week. So, yeah. I'll briefly mention it. Given the way the championship is going and given the fact that I think everybody understands that the Ford is going to be the car to beat, I'm slightly surprised he didn't make a bit more of an aggressive move or force the issue a little bit more, knowing Sutton's down the grid and not making any progress for whatever reason.
Yeah, it's sort of like balancing with one hand and trying to take with the other. The fact that he is up in fourth in this race, Sutton finishes down in 12th, that's a good points difference. And if he goes for that move around the outside of Noble, which was the only time he looked like he was going to make a move on Moffitt, if that doesn't come off and you break a splitter or you have to come to the pits because you've gone across the grass, then you're going to lose all the points that you're looking to gain. So it is, in that situation, more of a balancing act.
I agree, but it's not like he had anybody behind him. Collard wasn't too pressuring or wasn't putting up too much pressure behind him, you know. So I think he could have asked the question a little bit more and then decided to back out, but yeah. I don't think the question was even asked. Anyway, Collard in fifth from Aaron Taylor-Smith, rounding off a top day for him in sixth. Butcher 7th, Camish in 8th, Ingram 9th, Jake Hill 10th, Josh Cook 11th and Ashley Sutton 12th, with Watson, Doble and that man Dexter Patterson rounding out the top 15. Right, let's do our awards very quickly and then let's get into the meat of the discussions points from the weekend, because we'll have about 15 minutes or so, I reckon.
So driver of the weekend, there's only one man for it once again, isn't there? Has to be Sutton.
Yeah, it's not his greatest weekend.
Not his greatest weekend, no, but two wins, a pole.
Imagine that, two wins and a pole, and it's not his best weekend.
Yeah, the trouble is he's setting such high standards for himself now, and we have to reflect that in the grade, don't we?
We do, and for the grades, listen to our grade and prediction podcast.
Exactly.
Who was your villain of the weekend?
My villain of the weekend has to be Sam Osborne. For what we've seen from the other Fords, yes, Camish was fairly, I don't know, a bit average this weekend, but he finished every race inside the top eight. Rowbottom, we saw a charge from him in race three, having to make up the positions from the, obviously, starting 24th in race two. We saw some good overtakes from him, good pace. But Sam Osborne just didn't seem to have any pace, didn't seem to have any fight. Certainly not the Osborne that we saw at Snetterton. And I thought he would have done a lot better in the Jack Sears this weekend.
Yeah, that's understandable. I've gone for Bobby Thompson. I know it's not all his fault with the car, but he's lost the lead in the independents. He made a mistake in qualifying, which cost him potentially being higher up the grid. Did well in race one, came through the field and finished well, but it's a bit of a lost opportunity for both himself and the team. They've lost the lead in the team championship as well, or the independent team championship as well. And I think that Bobby set such high standards this season that these sort of races or weekends are going to stand out a little bit more. And a little bit disappointed of how it finished for him. And I'm sure he will be too.
Yeah, I can understand that. My good surprise of the weekend probably has to be Ingram. I didn't think the car was going to fare as well as it did in his hands this weekend. I thought he'd get some sort of like top five, top six finishes, but to take two podiums out of the weekend, and then of the three drivers in race three, he was the one that made the most progress. Pleasantly surprised, and it's another pointsy weekend, and he's still not that far off of Sutton when you compare him to the rest of the drivers in the championship hunt.
Yeah, it's a fair point. He's only 14 points back, which isn't a great deal at this stage of the season. You're right. My surprise good was PMR. Look, we thought they'd be good. I didn't think they'd be that good. I didn't think they'd be getting double points finish in every race. I didn't think they would be all in three inside the top 10. It's as simple as that. Aaron Taylor-Smith had his strongest showing of the season, I think.
Yep. Two eighths and a sixth for Taylor-Smith this weekend.
Yeah, very good. Lacked a little bit of race pace, but I mean, I'm being ultra picky there. They've done a fantastic job and far exceeded what I thought they would achieve this weekend, which would be a couple of points finishes and perhaps lower end points finishes.
Yeah.
Three top eights. Yeah, that's pretty good.
It is. My bad surprise of the weekend has to be Jelly.
We see
these weekends from Jelly where he has a real high 1 week and then he'll go to another track and just be absolutely nowhere. And that was one of those this weekend. He scored no points this weekend. Yes, he got caught up in the incident in race one, but there was no recovery. Considering Hill, Turkington and Morgan all had finishing positions within the top six, I was expecting a lot more, and for him to not even score points was very disappointing.
Yep, completely understand. I've gone for Edwards. I don't want to kick anybody while they're down, but this is the circuit which he enjoys, and I really thought this would be the weekend where, okay, it's never going to take a podium, let's be realistic, but where the fight back would come on a little bit and we'd see the corner get turned. And I don't know, I'm just looking at this thinking, where is it going to come? Yeah. Because if it's not come here, I'm gutted for her. I really am. But it's a surprise bad for me, just because I hoped rather than believed. Maybe that's the problem.
Too much hope, mate. It's the hope that kills you, isn't it?
So that sums up our driver awards. Now let's get into some of the issues of the weekend, more generally speaking, because there's not a lot to talk about race issues as we've discussed. So let's first of all start off with a hybrid. Let's do that one first before we move on to the Fords more generally. I don't want to repeat old ground. I've discussed hybrid to death on this podcast, but do we now both agree that it doesn't work? And I think that's even a view that's starting to get shared by some of the commentating team now as well.
It's certainly not working anywhere near what people thought it would be. The changes that were set into place for this year, we thought maybe change it up a little bit, having it being deployed at different speeds, at different lengths of time, different number of laps. But we're really not seeing any difference at all. When you've got Sutton coming into a weekend with 1 second of hybrid use during qualifying and still taking pole position by more than 0.2, it's quite obvious that it's not working.
Do you know what I think the biggest problem is?
Go on.
It's quite a left field, this. Because it has no difference, cars like Ford and Sutton don't have to change setup at all now. So if you're back to the ballast days, they had to constantly tweak the setup to accommodate the ballast, and that made it quite interesting because they didn't get the setup right. It was a problem, and they kept the teams on their toes. They had to keep constantly changing and from race to race as well, because obviously the ballast would change throughout the race weekend. Sutton has basically said, we've not touched that car since Brands. It doesn't need to, because he's got a setup that works. The hybrid makes no difference. So it doesn't need to account for a different setup to only allow for 1 second of hybrid to 15 seconds of hybrid, because there's no difference. Or not a discernible difference, which has basically meant that Napa have found a setup that works for Ash Sutton superbly well, and they're saying nothing away from them. It works brilliantly. But there's no need for the team to adapt or to think on their feet or to keep finding new ways to make the car fast. They've found the magic formula. They can sit on it now. It's fine.
The warning signs were there last year with this as well, because Ingram mentioned it. He said, look, now we don't have to change the car from race to race, have it running at different ballast levels, putting weight around in different places of the car to make sure you've got enough front end, you've got enough grip at the rear. He was able to set the car up from pretty much the start of the season, once he tuned it and fine-tuned it, and then was able to go on and take victories and take pointsy weekends where he could be ultra-consistent because he didn't have to change the car.
I completely agree. I think that is the biggest problem for me, is that you don't have to change the car setup. So once you've found that magic setup, okay, you'll make little tweaks, of course you will, but you're not having to make the huge tweaks you have to make with the ballast to make it work. And I think that's why we're seeing so many double race winners. I mean, Sutton's winning through on the bounce, that's incredible in its own right. But yeah, you look back to last year, I'm just having a quick look.
There were loads last year. I think there were 6 out of the 10 rounds at least that had double winners. And it's shown. I think people on social media have also been in contact with us and said, look, even on sim setups, we're having ballast added to the car to make it heavier. there's two things that ballast does. It makes it sluggish coming out of a corner, so you're going to get more momentum from a lighter car behind, and it also takes a lot more to stop it, so you're going to have to brake a lot area. Where do you get the most overtakes? Into braking zones and momentum coming out of braking zones. That is what...
I have to give you credit. It's what...
Go on.
Just, sorry, briefly, you're absolutely right. It's six. Well done.
Thank you.
Fair play.
So, yeah, to get the most out of a weekend and to make a race entertaining, you want these overtakes and these drivers swapping positions. And to do that, the most efficient way we've already seen is to add ballast to a car.
But I understand why ballast isn't popular. I get that. And I get that some people, and I've heard it mentioned on the P1 podcast as well, find it too gimmicky and find it too much of a too much of a gimmick, basically.
Do you know who it's mainly not popular with? People that are winning.
Yeah, I get that, I do, but I also get the sense that if you're a racing purist, it is a little bit gimmicky. I think the most simple option is to have, and I've said it before and I'll say it again, is to have DRS-style zones where the hybrid is powerful and it works to this car that's overtaking and you can't use it to defend. Because that, to me, is the only way you're going to see overtakes work.
To me, that is more gimmicky. Having stuff like that, yes, in F1 it does work. We do see, especially this weekend at Spain, I said to you during the race that the DRS zone is just long enough so the cars are able to get alongside each other, and then you have to complete the overtake on the brakes if you're brave enough to go around the outside or if you're diving down the inside. I don't think the touring cars would be akin to that because it's a different driving style, being saloon cars, and these cars have nowhere near as much downforce as you're seeing in F1. But having that ballast penalty, I think, works so much better in saloon cars because they're heavier. You've got to wrestle them around through the corners. And at tracks like Thruxton, for example, it is all about momentum.
To be clear, I'm not suggesting we have a DRS style with the wing opening. I'm suggesting we have a zone where the hybrid is actually powerful. We're talking about giving it an extra 60, 70 horsepower or something that... where you can see which adds an extra 20 kilometers an hour to your race pace or your speed. I think the other thing that I would suggest, because I don't really like ballast, I'll be honest with you, it works and I can't necessarily think of a better way, okay. And I accept that, but I don't fully like it either because I think we'll come on to that too. I don't like it with the Fords when we talk about whether this is good for the championship or not with Napa and all that kind of stuff, whether they should have reductions, which we'll get to. I think the other thing I would suggest is that we need to change up the formula for how race two is set up. Because if you've got a driver that's winning race one of these, let's not have the grid for race one is sets the grid for race two. Then let's look at doing your second qualifying lap sets your pace for race two, or something, your race pace in race one.
Fastest laps in race one.
Yeah, let's look at something like that. Or we have a grid reversal in race two rather than race three. Mm-hmm. So you actually get the reversal in the middle of the race, racing weekends.
There seem to be a lot of different setups through the other formulas and the other support series that we watch.
Yes.
And I don't think it would be out of the realms of possibility to... We've obviously already seen a change or a beginning of an implementation of a change with the qualifying setups and having the shootouts come up at different races throughout the season. So I don't see why we can't try different race setups throughout the season.
Agreed.
Say going into a race weekend, we have a full reverse grid for race one, and then you could work off a qualifying time for race two and something else for race three. There's lots of different options out there, I think.
I don't think a full reverse grid works because, and Sutton can make the point that, look, I was put in 12 for race three and couldn't make any progress. Yes. So actually, it's not as bad as you think it is. It's just the way it is if I get out front. Yeah, I think the answer is, if you're not going to go down the ballast route and if hybrid's not going to be improved to make it serious, I agree with you that you need to look at a way of changing the format for the weekend. I'm quite happy to qualifying set the grid for race one, or one of the races at least, but I think that at the minute, race two is the problem because you're getting so many double wins. You get the top eight being the same top eight twice, which is in touring cars isn't great, let's be honest. And I think that, let's look at the race format then. Let's change that up. I don't know how, and I'd be more than happy to hear how people would like to see that happen. I think I would do a reverse grid in race two personally, and then look at race three being either this where you finished race one or maybe where you finished race two. I'm not sure. I need to see how it actually worked with reversing the grid a race early.
You could even look into fastest lap times from race two, because if you've got people trying to work their way back through the grid, then their lap times might not be as quick as if they are already set out from.
Agreed. I agree with that. But that for me is how to deal with it. I don't like ballast particularly, so I'd look at changing the format of the weekend to accommodate the lack of ballast.
Yeah, that's fair.
Okay, the next issue then, which has been discussed, is should Ford and Napa have some kind of reductive penalty applied, whether that be a tone down in boost, whether that be a tone down in engine power, or if that be a boost setting go up to everybody else to improve their speed. Now, it's important to stress, again, that Ford aren't the quickest on the grid. You look at the speed traps, they're not the fastest on the grid. What they have got...
15th to 20th engine-wise through the speed traps, yeah. And it's not where they're making their time.
What they have got is a fantastic chassis and a fantastic setup that allows them to carry the speed through the corners.
Yeah.
So, first of all, before we get my view, do you think there should be any form of penalty applied to Napa to try and level the playing field?
Not to Napa, no.
To who?
We saw the whole controversy arise when we saw the BMWs be fastest through the speed traps, and they were the dominant car in the series, and they were taking the majority of wins and podiums and such like. That was because the car had a really strong engine built by Neil Brown and was very quick through the speed traps, and you could see sometimes how quick it was in a straight line. Obviously, they've got the extra bonus of having good traction out the corners, so you can get good traction, good top speed. You're more than likely going to be in a good position then to make the move at the end of a straight into a corner, which is where most of the overtaking is done. That you're able to balance out because it is a power-based thing. You're also going to have different setups, as it were, between rear-wheel drive and front-wheel drive cars. The fact that the Napa Ford is not anywhere near the quickest through a speed trap is important, because it is not solely power that they're doing this on, which is what the BMWs mainly lived off of. It is the fact that they've got, as you say, a very good chassis, something which Thruxton has shown this weekend with all three wins coming from a Ford, and a fast Ford at that, one that in race three was able to make huge progress in the hands of Rowbottom. And the fact that the chassis is so good that it has worked at every single circuit so far just proves how good a car it is. There must be other setup changes that other teams could probably do. It may just be a coincidence of shape of the car, chassis of the car, dare I say it, where the engine is placed in the car. As to it all working perfectly together as a package.
You make some good points, interesting points. Going back to the BMW, I think that there was a far bigger outcry on the grid from other drivers and other teams about where the engine was located in the BMW. I know we've made a bit of a joke on this podcast before, but it was being compared to, and by drivers on Twitter who were actually in the touring cars at the time, were going public on social media to complain about where the engine was placed in the car. Yeah. It was slightly more middle, and whether that was giving them too big an advantage, coupled with the rear-wheel drive power traction off the line and off the corners.
But wasn't something that was changed.
It wasn't, but their boost was reduced.
Their boost was reduced, yes. And as I said, it was... The placement of the engine in the car, as far as I'm aware, shouldn't make a difference to the amount of top speed a car should have.
No, but it does make a difference to the balance of the car.
Certainly.
And that kind of stuff. Yes. And I think it's fair to say that there was a little bit of outcry from other drivers and other teams about how that car was set up for the year. I'm not seeing the same murmurs or complaints towards the Napa car as of yet, whether that will come as the season goes on, but I'm not seeing it. If you could point it out to me, fine, but I'm not seeing the same level of complaints and grumblings about it. I also think with Napa, what you've got is a team that have taken a very average car from last year, and it was average. It was fine, but it was average.
There were question marks over whether they were going to use it this season.
Yeah, absolutely. And they were away behind the best two cars, which were clearly the BMW and the Hyundai last year, clearly. Yeah. What they've done is they've worked on it all winter and they've produced an absolute monster of a car. Ash has been in the sim practically non-stop all winter as well.
And
he's a very good driver.
I was going to say, if you haven't noticed, he's already a three-time champion. Just putting that out there. He's quite quick.
He's a third of the way to Plato's win number, and I think he beats it. If he stays in touring cars, he beats it. It's as simple as that. It's a good combination. I do not think that Napa should be punished in any way, shape or form, because for a couple of reasons. One, they're a manufacturer and we want manufacturers in the sport. And if you start penalising manufacturers for building good racing cars, then why on earth would they stick around in the sport? What's the point? Two, unless the success has been achieved through financial doping or cheating or something like that, I don't think it should be punished. Right. If you've come up with a... Mercedes dominated Formula One for several years. Was it great? No, but you can't knock what they did. And it's the same with Red Bull now. Verstappen is going to win this title with about nine races to go. Yep. But they're not cheated yet. Well, it's not been... There's no allegation of cheating at the moment. We'll see about cost cap later in the year. But you know, what they have done, and even Toto Wolff was this week, the principal of Mercedes, was saying it would be ludicrous to penalise them or to pull them back, because what they have done is they've understood the brief and they've built a ridiculous car. And you've got to, as much as annoying, you've got to tip your hats to them and say, yeah, fair play. The onus has got to be on us to catch up.
Yeah, I think the onus is very much on the other teams, is that they can see that Ford have built a really good car and Napa have built a really good car. And dare I say that, what's the engineering team that Sutton brings with him? BMR are known for building a really good car.
Yeah.
And it's just a case of the perfect storm almost. And because they're at the top, they're the easiest to shoot at.
I mean, look at the cars Sutton has won his championships in. One was a barge in the Subaru that should never, Rick Rydell-esque, should never ever be winning a touring car championship based on looks alone, let's be fair. You've then done it in the Infiniti, which looked terrible before he joined and terrible after he left. Yeah, it wasn't a car that anybody else fancied, and it's off the grid. And actually, in Parfitt's hands last year as well, it looked appalling. Mm. And bearing in mind that Moffitt would have likely been racing Sutton's race-winning car last year, it looked absolutely dreadful. Yeah. So he doesn't do things by halves. He was taking wins in the MG when he was back in that. Yeah, he's a very, very fast driver. He's a generational talent, and he's one of the best, if not the best, on the grid at the moment.
But do you know, and I'll mention it again, it's the fact that once Sutton leaves a team and takes BMR with him and his engineering team and his mechanics, that the team seemed to go downhill. The team, especially in that Laser Tools Infinity, very much relied on the setups of Sutton, I think, and the fact that BMR could build such a good car.
They still would have had his setups left behind, though.
Setups, yes, but if the car is built differently by a different engineering team, each engineering team can have their own views. Look at the success that Barry Plowman has brought in at Autobike Cupra this season since he's moved across there.
But my point would also be is that if this car was so unbeatable, it'd be 1, 2, 3 every weekend. Yeah. Now, I know that Sutton's taken 6 wins out of 12. I know there's been a Napa on the podium every single race, but it's not 1-2. Have they had a 1-2 yet?
Not on the top of my mind.
So, yeah, it's not like Cambridge is coming home second every weekend. And Cambridge is no slouch. Let's get this right. No. You know, he was one corner away from being a champion of this sport.
Don't remind me of that again.
But he was. He's no slouch. Yeah, and he's not on Sutton's level this season, I don't think. Rowbottom isn't a bad driver, and he's not third in the championship. Osborne is one of the most experienced drivers in the Jack Sears Trophy and isn't winning it at the moment. Patterson's leading the way in that. So, you know, I don't think it's enough just to say the car's fast. Yes, of course it is, but you've still got to be able to drive it. And this is the thing that, you know I'm not a humongous fan of the Mercedes dominance.
No.
But you can't just say to look the fact that Lewis won all his titles because of the car, because Valtteri Bottas didn't. The only driver who won it in equal machinery was Rosberg, and it damn near killed him.
Yes. Yeah, very much so.
So, you know, and you look at the Red Bull this season, which is by far and away the fastest car on the grid, yet Perez is 2 DNFs away from Max Verstappen now. sometimes.
I thought you were going to say two DNFs away from Danny Ricciardo sitting in.
Well, yeah, there's that as well. But yeah, sometimes you just get the great combination of a really quick driver and a really good car, and when that comes together, it could be very difficult to stop. Yes. And I think that's where we're at. And I certainly don't advocate any form of setback to Napa, because ultimately you're here to build the best car, you're here to go the fastest. If you get it right, why on earth would you punish that? And I know people are saying, well, the spectacle's been lost, it's not as exciting this year. Well, I'd rather have that as a racing purist than have all the cars level and, you know, not have that competitiveness at the top. If you like that sort of thing, club racing, watch that. That's very exciting. But is it the greatest quality? No, it's not. And that's no disrespect to club racing at all. It's a good bit of, it's good fun, but it's not the prestige, is it? You don't, nobody sets out to want to be the Citroën C1 Cup champion.
Depends on their budget.
Okay, most people don't dream of becoming the Citroën CV, 2CV champion. They want to be the touring car champion. Yeah.
No, I understand that.
I'm not trying to be disrespectful before you, because you're smirking, but you know what I'm trying to say.
Yes, yeah, I completely understand what you're trying to say. People are always trying to aim for the top, and the BTCC is the pinnacle of saloon car racing and tin top racing in the UK.
You want to play for Man City. You don't want to play for Stockport Town your entire life, do you? No footballer sets out and wants to be, you know, at Stockport level, for argument's sake. They want to be at Man City level, don't they? Yeah. Let's be honest.
Yeah. We would both love to hear everyone's views on this, because it is a subject that I think will roar on throughout the season. And there will be, I'm sure, many more wins to come from Sutton this season. Whether we will see more dominance come from the Napa Ford is yet to be seen. But I certainly think he's going to be setting the pace for the foreseeable future, if not the rest of this year, then possibly a couple more years to come if he stays in that car. I'd love to hear your thoughts about it.
I think that pretty much sums up this pod. I've got one very last quick question for you that is a complete curveball, so I do slightly apologise.
Okay, ready.
Rowbottom's incident in race two, a clear push to pass, could that not have been dealt with during the race and him giving a penalty during the race rather than afterwards?
Yeah, I think I said to you at the time, the fact that Pearson dropped down a couple of places probably made it a little more difficult to act upon at the time. I think if it had been a straight swap of positions, then a position reversal would have been absolutely perfect, because I think he would have gotten a pass anyway. A three place grid drop for the next race doesn't really help Pearson out in any way.
No, exactly. That's more my point.
I think it was the fact that Pearson lost positions is the reason that Rowbottom got that type of penalty.
Yeah, but as you say, it doesn't help him. It doesn't help Pearson, does it?
Not at all.
There we go. Do you have any final thoughts of the weekend then, Sam?
Thruxton let me down a bit. And I know it's not your favourite circuit. I thought it was a little bit processionary this weekend out. And I'm looking forward to seeing what we can next time out at Alton Park. But the minis were bloody brilliant.
Yeah, that is my final thought, is that I don't know the logistics, but Alan Gow, please, please, please sign up the Mini Miglia and the Mini Sevens. They were such fun. They were so good to watch. I'm not going to pick on any particular series and say it was better than that, but yeah, it was.
It's just
sublime.
All round entertainment, drivers giving their absolute all in these cars that really shouldn't be going that quickly.
And it was great to see Andy Jordan, Mike Jordan and Jeff Smith back in and around the touring car paddock as well. But the minis were, to see them going, you know, four or five wide through church is sublime.
It's ridiculous.
And yeah, let's get them on the touring car calendar more often, please, because they just bring a smile to your face, don't they?
Certainly do. If you've enjoyed it, please do leave us a like. We will, of course, be back once again with our driver grades coming up next, and then obviously an Alton Park preview. Again, another one we will be watching from the sofa. Yours, I believe, next time around.
It is my turn.
And in the meantime, please do go back and have a listen to any other of our podcasts. And if you have any thoughts on what you would like us to make during the off-season or even this mid-session or mid-season break, should I say, then please do let us know.
Yeah, we're looking for topics for particularly the 10-minute chats with us. What would you like us to have a quick chat about? Thanks.
Bye.
Bye.
Hi there, it's Sam here. If you're enjoying this podcast, why don't you leave us a like and don't forget to subscribe. You can also leave us a 5-star review, and we're also on social media at Facebook and Instagram